fields. And maybe if the American underclass, forgive my language, were to engage in that type of work, it would elevate the understanding about it. And we would look at stoop labor differently than we look at it now. The way we look at it now is we don't look at it. Because we have loopholes in the law that allow us to import people from out of the country to do the dirtiest of the dirty work.
Jerry's got a response.
I really believe, and I think you may be missing one of my feelings, or one of the reasons I feel this way, is that I think the stoop labor that you are talking about being imported, that the Europeans is to the corporate system in America. We are not becoming a society of gardeners. I happen to be a permaculturalist, and we are not fostering a culture where we are raising more of our own food, teaching dependence. I mean, when are we going to have a homeful garden, not a homeless garden?
I think
providing a culture where these people can exist and help taking care of themselves may well be the answers, more than fulfilling the needs of a corporate farm community where gardening becomes less and less the issue, culture becomes less and less the issue, and it is all money.
Well, let me respond briefly to that. This thing about the indigenous happy gardener and the disconnected cottage worker, the fact is that the mere fact that we're having this conversation right now on some very, very sophisticated technology that could only exist with vast infrastructures, with multinationals, with large organizations.
Well,
integrated circuits, plastics, transmission lines. These are very, very massive infrastructure, and they don't come about by indigent cottage industry gardeners showing up at a once-a-week farmer's market. It doesn't happen that way.
Well,
it cannot happen that way. We're so far past that it's irrelevant.
I don't think it can be I think it's very, very dangerous when not becoming part of that structure and staying part of a different structure or a different group of people becomes dangerously risky in this society to the point where you are criminalized because of that position.
Oh, I don't think so, Jerry.
I think a lot of the town may want to go around criminalizing the homeless and thinking that's the solution. No, I don't believe it to be the solution.
I think that one can pull back if that's one's choice, and one can do it with some degree of responsibility. And people do it with trust funds, of course. They're not productive. I mean, being on a trust fund, inheriting money, okay, is not necessarily being productive. Right, but you can pull back in different ways. You haven't got to become a corporate hack necessarily, but in some degree, we owe some accountability to the general economics that sustains us. And once again, I mean, migrant workers, field workers, even to float it as a trial balloon, as a temporary option, is so distasteful for you and your guests that it's not even considered to be valid.
No, what's distasteful is the idea that somehow people have to work in order to have a right to exist. That's just a right to have any non-criminal status.
Well, if they don't work, Robert, and they don't inherit money, and they're not getting a check from Uncle Sam, how are they surviving?
Well, let me put it this way. I'm not putting it quite properly. I think people have a responsibility to contribute to the community in some sense.
Economically?
Yeah, in terms of taking, you know, because when you take from the community, you should contribute to the community.
Economically.
However, the problem with compulsory schemes, and given the current maldistribution of wealth and power in this country, and the fact that you can't make reasonable contributions to the community and get reasonable return generally, I mean, it's not, I would say it is, for people in a homeless condition, that is very problematic. And, you know, I'm not saying that there are all kinds of different WPA-type projects that might not be helpful and that wouldn't be welcomed by homeless people as a voluntary option as they were in the 30s when they were introduced, you know, in the mid-30s in the middle of the Depression. But I think that to somehow suggest that homeless people are to blame, that he's not being...
Number one, I never said the word compulsory. You're using that word.
Okay, okay.
I said even to advocate it as a serious option is so distasteful to many that it's not taken seriously.
Well, I don't know. Is it distasteful to have the option advocated, guys? I mean, you think that you find it...
I really feel like you have to decriminalize... you have to quit making criminals of the homeless. That they have all options open, everybody does. And to criminalize a class of people is just extremely dangerous.
I think those are separate arguments.
Yeah, I think Bob here agrees. I mean, you, in fact, were behind the first initiative.
I'm saying that there is an economic reality to survival in 2002 planet Earth.
Yeah, no, I think that's
agreed. I think to not acknowledge that is hokey, mm-hmm. nonsense, pseudo-green eco-feminist anarchist garbage.
However, it's also true that you can live on the margins of society and contribute as well, and that sometimes that kind of contribution can be very important to the society.
Well, contribution, if it's not economic...
Hey, there are all kinds
it's
of...
It's not real, Robert.
I don't think that's true, Bob. I think that there are many different kinds of contributions.
Well, okay, then, you know, let's say I want to be a poet, and I should be able to survive on my poetry, and if I can't, well, then it's not my fault. It's the fault of the corporations. Come on, man. It's crazy.
Well, it depends. But, you know, to say that poetry has no value, and the only thing that has value is digging ditches,
you know. That's not what I said.
All right, well...
Well, poetry is not... That, well, it doesn't have that much of a track record for being economically received.
There are many kinds
received.
Of contributions, and the fact that some things have more economic, you know, punch than other things doesn't mean they have more social value. I'm sorry.
It's my understanding that Blake, who was a poet, lived very meagerly and came close to starvation, but he also found ways to integrate his need to write with doing menial jobs.
Right, and a lot.
Labor.
Sure.
He worked.
Hey, Charles Bukowski did too.
I mean, okay. So this whole thing about, you know, I deserve to contribute in whatever way I want without even the attempt.
You're fighting a straw man.
Without
what
even the
did.
Attempt at an economic reality, to me, is absolutely dishonest.
Yeah, okay, so Jerry wants to comment on this.
Yeah, I think you brought in one fact that was very strong in this, and that you go farm labor. And my contention is that there's many alternatives. I'm not anti-corporation. I believe that when you have a category of saying, this is the answer, and it's the corporate farm labor, I don't believe that to be the only answer. I believe that ego villages may very well. I believe that when we are going to take our weapons and beat them into plowshares, that we will be taking our technology and becoming more civilized. And I don't think it will just be with any one group or just one situation where farm labor. There's many things, healthcare providers. I've always abdicated that. I've told people that if I was homeless and on the streets, that I'd look for a yard that was starting to go, because I'm a gardener and I always look at the garden. And you'll find an older person. I used to work with senior citizens. Even at St. Francis, we teamed up people with senior citizens to help them keep their yards and stuff done. And it's productive to both sides. And it isn't just going to work for the corporate farm. It isn't just standing in line for the corporation that needs you, that there's a lot of creative alternatives.
And indeed, Santa Cruz Service Corps, Camp Paradise, works on that very premise. And they, you know, they farm out their jobs, and that's what they've been doing, as you know, based in a homeless encampment.
Let me get my last response.
Okay.
And Santa Cruz Service Corps, put them to work in the fields.
Mm-hmm. What is your obsession with the fields, Bob?
Because it's so obvious. It's so obvious as an incredible job bank. Because Americans find that kind of work so
distasteful. I know, you're stuck on that. Bob, you get stuck on these ideas and you keep repeating them.
No, I'm repeating them because they don't seem to be really getting
I want some more information.
Bigger.
I want more information from you about how much it pays, what kinds of skills
are
required.
It pays enough to keep people alive, Robert, obviously, even at the meager scale that it is right now.
If you have an extended Hispanic community of people where you can move into their house with a bunch of other folks,
it doesn't require that kind of research. It requires the fact that people survive and thrive off of it, and they move on from it.
No, they survive and thrive because of their culture.
Then
white people can't do it in Santa Cruz. They don't have that kind of culture where you can't move into a house with a bunch of people in the way that extended Hispanic families can.
There are migrant labor camps that exist in California now.
So you think all the homeless in Santa Cruz should move to a migrant labor camp somewhere?
Let's put that at the top of the priority of the options list.
Oh, well. Last
couple of comments here. Weapons of plowshares and eco-villages. It's just a lot of hooey and woo-woo. Escapism for people that don't even want to make the attempt to acknowledge that somebody picks up the tab.
Okay, well, thank you, Bob.
I think that's absolutely ridiculous.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I don't understand if he was actually advocating a forced labor system for the homeless, or if it was actually going to be making.
I don't think it was forced.
Making it available to people who are willing to work, but his comment put him to work in the fields. I don't quite understand what he's saying there.
Okay.
But I could say that eco-villages and culture and these things exist, and they're very viable. They're very viable. I've seen them with my own eyes.
Yeah, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi. I'd love to hear Bob. He always stirs up the shit.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not you like what he's stirring up, he definitely gets people thinking. I only caught part of what he was saying, so I'm going to just respond to the part I heard.
Mm-hmm.
Putting people to work in the fields, there probably are other places that people could work. The issue of wages in Santa Cruz is a big one. It seems to me like if you're going to be very idealistic, why not go after a living wage for all private employers in Santa Cruz so you can't locate here unless you pay, I don't know, whatever, $12. I guess that would screw up the economy because then the rents would go up even higher.
$18 actually, I think, is living wage. I mean, they say, you know, they have living wage in quotes, it's $12, but actually it's around 18, 17.
But you can't do that in a private sphere, right? You can't say, borders, you have to pay X. That's not allowed, right?
Well, there is such a thing as a minimum wage, you know, and that's done in the private sphere, so I suppose in theory it could be done. Again, I can't...
I doubt that.
Well, you know...
Our council, I'm sure, is hard at work on this.
Yeah, right.
They can't even go after rent control.
No. They can't, and that's the
It's funny to me how people think of Santa Cruz as this liberal, even socialist mecca, especially when you hear those KSCO assholes. It's, you know, we're not that.
No.
We're San Jose light.
Yeah, or even worse, because San Jose at least has some minorities and has a movement for rent control.
Oh, they do?
Oh, yeah.
Well, are they on the verge of getting it?
They're trying to get a just eviction law. In fact, the previous caller who was, you know, talking about the farm labor, Bob, has also been very interested in rent control.
He's
floated a rent control initiative. He's been to some of the San Jose meetings, so perhaps at some point if he has more details for us, he can call back and give us an update on that.
Yeah, one of the things I appreciate about your work, Robert, is you just on them all the time, and you call them on their hypocrisies. And so does Bob. I mean, they say they're progressives, but they won't put it up to a vote, rent control. They say, oh, we don't have the votes, right?
Mm-hmm. And so do Jerry and Scott here. I don't know if you've been looking in the Good Times or the Sentinel or the Metro, but Scott has had a number of letters exposing the hypocrisy around the yuppie planter issue where they were.
Can city council vote in rent control, or does it need to be on the ballot?
No, they can vote it in.
They can do it right now.
Four votes, yeah. That's all they need.
So who do you perceive as supporting it, if anybody?
Nobody, but, you know, there are people who claim to be that they might...
Well, Crone doesn't support it.
Well, Crone is a landlord, for one thing, and Crone... But that doesn't mean he doesn't support it. There's some landlords who think it might be more effective, too, or who feel that, you know, that there's a, you know, there has to be a compassionate ground-level floor for, or ceiling, I should say, for rents. Well, you know,
are you saying none of them support it?
Well, none of them support it enough.
To the extent to bring it up.
Right, I mean, they talk about rent control when they're trying to push their Dolphin Lee project.
That's the stupidest fucking thing I've ever heard.
Right, the rent subsidized, you know, give away all the affordable housing money for 5 to 10, 15 years in order to, you know, benefit, well, I mean, it does benefit a few people, but it, you know, it's so few compared to how many could be benefited. I mean, Mark Premack, whom I disagree with on almost everything, I agree with on that, and he at least had the courage to bring up some of those issues at city council.
What you're saying is there are people on the council who support it in principle and say we can't bring it up because it won't win.
It's more
who are those people?
Well, the people we voted in, I would say people like Porter, and again, I haven't talked to Porter about rent control. I'm thinking more of his response on homelessness, but he's considered one of the more liberal people on the council.
Okay, Porter.
Fitzmaurice, Crone, Sugar. I mean, these folks...
So that's four.
And that is four. And then, you know, Kennedy and Riley are always also possibilities. I don't think Premack supports rent control, but again, I'm not sure. I've always invited these fine council people to call this program, but for some reason they aren't on the air with me, so if you have any way of getting them on.
The main objection, reasonable objection I've heard to rent control is this clause or whatever at the state level that says vacancy...
Vacancy decontrol means that rent control will only be in effect so long as... you're actually occupying the apartment. The minute you move out, they can raise the rents. But, you know...
But you think the landlords would like, you know, that would be another plane of support because they have, you know, they're not locked in. They're free to raise it when people leave.
But that's because of the, what's it called, the Costa-Hawkins Act of the mid-90s. And, of course, that should be changed so that we can have real rent control. I mean,
Are you saying you would deny landlords the right to control their own rents? Are you, some kind of commie?
Well, Michael Schmidt, who's Mr. Businessman and who was, you know, CEO for the Area Chamber of Commerce, said that he thinks, you know, renting is a business, and you should get a business license to rent. You don't have to do that in Santa Cruz, for example, because, you know, I mean, it affects human beings in ways that need to be, at least to some extent, overseen by the community, particularly in a market. I mean, I'm telling you things you know already, you know, that where profiteering is the name of the game. And so, I mean, the question you have is, I think, really the key question, and I think rent control isn't on the agenda of the Right to Sleep Summit per se. But obviously, when the rents are driving people into the streets, people have to go to encampments and have to find some way to sleep.
I want to focus on the rent control just briefly.
Yeah.
I've been told by very well-meaning liberal people that rent control never works because of this vacancy decontrol thing. And I always wonder what they mean by doesn't work. Does that mean that people just stay in their units forever?
Well, no, what it means is it doesn't work means that it doesn't do any good to have a rent control law because the minute somebody moves out, landlords can raise the rents exorbitantly and do...
Okay, so
but you see, that's
it
not...
It doesn't do the thing it's supposed to do.
But that's to some extent a specious argument because, as I understand from San Jose, they're pushing for a just eviction law, which when combined with rent control means that people will not be able to be evicted unless there's just cause to evict them. So if you have a just eviction law, landlords can't just tell you to leave and then and hike up the rents. There has to be some other provision. Now,
I would hope that would be already built into law, but I guess not.
It is not.
They can say, I don't like you. Get out of here.
For those who want more information like yourself, TRUSC, Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, is a good resource. And you can contact them by calling 426-0644. Again, Grab a pencil, 426-0644, TRUSC, Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, are also on the net, and they propose a couple of model laws.
Does the vacancy fee control have built into it a percentage of how much they can raise it, or they can just raise it to whatever?
They can raise it to whatever.
Okay.
Now, the rent stabilization laws, however, limit the amount that can be raised, but I don't think it is unlimited once people move out, so...
somebody hamstrung that puppy.
Oh, it's a landlord lobby, just like police lobbies. Very powerful in this state, as I understand it. But you see, if
I Bob has been like the main voice for that in Santa Cruz over the last, what, three
yes,
years?
Yes, he has. Bob and Donna Dice.
And I've signed petitions, and we still don't have it, so...
Well, your concerns, I think, are shared by thousands of Santa Cruzans. And it just amazes me that this council gets away with what it gets away with. I mean, I'd love to see you and Bob and others team up with a rent control proposal. I mean, there's an election coming up. This should be an election issue. If people don't support rent control, they shouldn't be voted in. It's very
simple. Part of the dynamic be the students? Not staying for long enough to feel committed to the community
and the massive university growth, so that...
They're thinking 15,000, I heard.
The housing is taken out of, you know, is swooped down and seized by the university's endless rapacious growth.
Yeah, and I heard Crone on the KZSC talk show with, I don't know, Mike Sammet, I guess, and he asked that question about university growth, and he said, well, you know, the city council has meetings with them, and we make them aware of our concerns, and they tell us their concerns, and basically, they have no power to do anything.
No, they do
consult
have...
with this private entity about how fast they're going to grow.
No, they have power.
And they can't stop them.
No, disagree. They have power. They could set up restrictions that stop the university from...
What kind?
Well,
like
they could
zoning laws?
Water use, for example. They've given away huge amounts of water to the university. They could have stopped that last year. But instead, they cave in to these university requests. You know, they cave in to what the university wants. And not in every case, but certainly... You know, where it doesn't...
You're saying they should cut their water down and say, now try to grow, eh?
Well, they don't have to provide them with huge amounts of water encouraging them to grow. That's what they're doing, you know?
I guess maybe from the perspective of the people on the council who aren't doing anything about expansion, they're thinking, well, you know, more students, more businesses, more money spent here, more... And they're not too worried about the rent inflation.
Well, I think a lot of it is... Well, the thing that fits Morris, who's horrible on almost all these issues, and... I have a personal...
You have a vendetta.
I have a personal hostility towards old Tim. Actually not. I mean, personally, we say hi, it's fine. But since they were elected, he's been the worst since of the group. I mean, I suppose Kennedy is worse than he is. I don't want to leave him out. It's hard to say who gets the worst. But Fitzmaurice's claim is that if you had even any discussion of rent control at city council, all the landlords would raise their rents. So it's a very dangerous topic to bring up.
Because they would raise it prior to whatever the law was.
Of course, it's quite simple. The response to that is, yes, then you introduce retroactive rent control, which is also quite legal. So if the landlords choose to raise their rents in exorbitant ways, then you cut them back, way back, you know?
Seems to me like one of the big political divisions in Santa Cruz, maybe everywhere, is do you own property or don't you? Because if you do, you'll have a certain set of attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
Almost uniformly, just about the need. I hear so many people bitching about private property, and they're all the people who have it.
Mm-hmm.
That seems right, very selfish. But I guess if I'm not them, so maybe I would be like them.
There are a lot of people who own property in Santa Cruz, and there are a number of people who are small property owners. And, you know, some of these people are concerned about bureaucracies. But the fact that this issue cannot be rationally discussed, and, you know, I mean, Schmidt had a very good proposal for having a sort of a fair rate of increase, rent stabilization, where every year it raises with the cost of living, perhaps, but no more. You know, I mean, these are reasonable things that would meet landlords.
What happened to that?
When Schmidt tried to have a town meeting on these issues, the city council pulled back, and, of course, Premack jumped into the race. He was running against the supervisor, Wormhout, who is also useless on rent control, by the way, in case you haven't noticed. We need to raise the issue again, as you are doing, and we need to do it in a public way. In fact, Bob himself was trying to put together a rent control forum, but we didn't quite get enough backing for it.
I wonder if it would pass. It was on the ballot.
Well, this is the other excuse that people like Mike Rock.
It almost got in last time, right?
No, I wouldn't say it almost got in. I'd say that...
There was a signature gathering drive.
There was a signature, but again, that was for an advisory proposal. Didn't even have any...
Just sort of a vote of confidence, you know, saying, want this.
I mean, what you want to do is, I would say, have a massive call into city council demanding it be put on the city council agenda for at least preliminary discussion.
And where do the masses come from? I don't know. You'd think the students would be behind it, but like I said, that transience thing.
Well, it takes people like...
They don't think they're going to be here long enough to bother.
It takes people like yourself going out and organizing. It really does. And you may not have time to do it. That's one of the problems. People are doing two and three jobs.
So last question. If you win your suit, are you getting damages?
How much
money are you going to make?
Okay, the suit I'm doing, of course, for those who don't know, is I raised my arm in a silent Heil Krone salute, and I was arrested, taken to jail, and so forth. The suit is
talking about a tempest in a teapot.
You got it. you want to see the actual incident, go to www.santacruz.indymedia.
You're probably going to win. So what do you get?
I would get damages for time in jail, time in handcuffs, humiliation, emotional distress, and then punitive damages for violation of civil rights,
right.
that chill of speech. I don't know. I really don't. I've never undertaken such a lawsuit before. You know, I'm frankly, I don't have much confidence in the courts. I think they're, run by conservative judges. You got Rehnquist at the top. What can you hope for?
Seems like a pretty clear
but it is.
Case in your favor.
It is so clear. And then the other thing that I'm really looking for, as you probably know, because you sound like you've been listening to this, is I want to see the council's decorum rules thrown out. So that only if
more decorum.
Well, the decorum has to be secondary to the First Amendment. And, you know, if something disrupts the council, certainly, you know, the council can call itself to order and demand that stop. But punishing people for the content of what they say,
or don't say,
a sign held up in the audience or a tape recorder brought up to the mic, these are things that are now forbidden. Using the word flunky, using the word Führer, these are all illegal under Fitzmaurice's decorum rules as he's interpreted them and announced them when he was mayor.
Well, so whatever damages you get, I'm sure you'll plow them back into local homeless activity.
Well, I'm thinking of going to Tahiti.
After you go to Tahiti, you can use those funds for something.
Taking some fancy women to Tahiti.
You know, I had an interesting experience recently trying to get some food from the university cafeteria into local homeless shelters, and I found out that almost none of them had the personnel to come and pick it up. I said, oh, sure, we'll take donations, but we can't come get it on the schedule. I'm thinking, well, shit.
Right, why can't they?
I mean, they don't have the money to pick up free food.
Actually,
they don't have one person with a car who can do this. And, I mean, the River Street shelter, I don't know what was up with this asshole. He said, oh, we don't need any. I think you probably do.
We actually have a man here whose main work is distributing food to people who are hungry. That's Jerry Henry. Jerry, what's
food,
your...
Are you a Food Not Bombs guy?
No. I was actually doing better food distribution until the Sergeant Pee Wee, who I refer to as Pee Wee Hemingroyd, took my license away. And
what were you doing?
I was distributing food. I was picking up New Leaf, Aptos Natural, Kelly's, Odwalla, and distributing to organizations and to individuals. And I originally got into this doing compost, and I saw this humongous quantity of food, and there's really not a shortage of food. There is a real shortage of the distribution of food. And I tried to fill a niche.
Who are committed and who can say, I'll do this at a certain time and be very reliable? You know, it's all volunteer efforts, so... level of commitment.
Yeah, at New Leaf, that's one of the reasons I was successful at New Leaf and stuff. I think in 97, 98, I did not miss a day.
And, of course, there was a group called Feed the People that I think you worked with Sean Alini when he was still alive.
I like the show. I'm going to get off so you can
Thank you very much.
I mean, we talk about a lot of stuff. You can get more calls on those issues.
Thanks, caller.
Bye.
Yeah, while Sean Alini was alive, he and John Earth did an organization, Feed the People, which was actually more high-profile than Food Not Bombs, which kind of moved off to the shadows of the town clock and, you know, was doing its stuff kind of in a more quiet, low-profile way. But Feed the People fed downtown on Pacific Avenue, where people gathered and, of course, attracted some police hostility, but continued their work. And you were doing that pretty regularly, Jerry, as I remember.
Yes, until the police became real active on me, and I've been in court the last 3-4 years.
Right, Jerry's been in court, and that's one of the reasons we called him here today. Maybe we can seg you into that. I actually brought along some documents from his... glory days here. Let's see if we can get this together. Jerry is, and we've talked about this before, he has been harassed at the Aptos Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. Before we go into that, though, I think we have a few more comments. Here's an incoming call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Wow, you must have a popular show for half an hour to call in.
Wow, here, let me pump you up here and pump this down and... guys, you can listen through the earphones if you can. It sounds like Richard Edmondson of...
Well, you're right, it is, Robert. I figured since I've been playing a 3-week-long game of phone tag with you, the only way I'm ever going to get in touch with you is to call into your radio program.
Well, I've tried to avoid you, Richard, but, you know, you've seen through my guises.
Yeah, well, no, you can't get away from me. So how are things going down there?
We are kind of stumbling forward as usual. We have this Right to Sleep Summit, which I've been talking about on the air, which coming up next weekend, starting about 5 o'clock on Friday. I guess that's 5 days from now, on May 3rd. Going to run all through May 4th, and then on May 5th there'll be a meeting of San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness, California Homeless Civil Rights Organizing Projects, actually, a statewide group. So we're working on how to mount a campaign this summer to decriminalize the homeless, perhaps starting with the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz or something else, and also to get these tent cities together from different places that go beyond the idea of just decriminalizing sleep to providing mutual support for homeless people where they actually can start, you know, going to work, their possessions can be taken care of during the day, their dogs and so forth, their, you know, their families, and they can go out and work and come back somewhere, since rents, of course, as you know, are impossible.
That would have been so ideal. I mean, when I was, you know, living in my vehicle, you know, just to be able to go out and work somewhere and leave my dog behind knowing that she would be all right. Of course, I wasn't married, but I did have a dog. I didn't have any children, but a dog. But, I mean, it's big...
Well, you can't have everything.
I know. That's the shame of it. But anyway, I mean, it would have been, you know, something like that would have been so helpful.
Are you able to receive us up there in San Francisco?
No, not over the airwaves.
I'm thinking of, in the internet, you can get free radio at www.microradio.net/FRSC for any of you who are interested, and you might want to try us there, see if you can tune
in. Okay, well, I have a hard time listening to internet radio because I'm such a slow computer and such a slow dial-up connection that it's difficult for me to listen to it, but...
Mm-hmm.
I will try to get down to Santa Cruz. I can't make it next Friday. I've got some people are coming over here to do a tutorial.
Well, come down on Saturday.
I'll definitely try to do that.
Tell us a little bit about what's happening with San Francisco Liberation Radio. Your station is really one of the oldest, and you, of course, actually written a whole book about it, the name of which is, Rising Up?
Yeah, it's called Rising Up, Class Warfare in America from the Streets to the Airwaves. And it's available on Amazon.com if anyone would like to go out and purchase a copy of it. It basically tells the story pretty much of the last 10 years when we first started coming up with the idea of putting our own radio station on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of got started, it was about a year or so, I guess, after the Gulf War, and this funny little booklet started showing up in info shops and bookstores around the Bay Area called The Complete Manual of Pirate Radio by Zeke Teflon, which supposedly told you everything you needed to know to start a pirate radio station. Well, as it turned out, it wasn't quite as complete as the title would have you believe, but anyway, it got a lot of people to thinking. And also around this time, Keith McHenry and I began to produce a radio program called the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, which the very first program we produced was on the Rodney King uprising and Frank Jordan's declaration of martial law in San Francisco, the actual 10th anniversary of which is coming up in a couple of days, or maybe tomorrow. But anyway, we were doing this radio program, and in an effort to get it aired on some actual radio stations, we sent out a 750-piece mailing to public radio stations all over the country. And out of that 750-piece mailing, we got back exactly one reply. And that was from a small college radio station in Cleveland, Ohio. And, so we were thinking, you know, it's really great that the listening public in Cleveland is going to know the truth about martial law in San Francisco, but, you know, what about maybe getting this program aired on a station a little bit closer to home? And so that's when we started thinking in terms of just putting our own radio station on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So all that was about 10 years ago. And actually, just Friday night, we had a little event over at AK Press in Oakland, kind of marking the anniversary of 10 years of micro radio in the Bay Area.
What's the status of micro radio in San Francisco and Berkeley? I know there are two stations that are on yours, San Francisco Liberation Radio, and then I guess what's it called? It's not Free Radio Berkeley, it's called something else?
It's called Berkeley Liberation Radio, which, you know, basically it's the same group of people who were...
Well, I know they were kind of driven off the air when Stephen Denifer, who was sort of... you know, big in the radio movement in the early and mid-90s, was finally enjoined by Claudia Wilkin from broadcasting without a license.
Correct. And people can actually read all about the history of that.
In Rising Up?
Rising Up.
Which
but
is
yeah,
not a...
Claudia Wilkin after something like a 4 or 5 year struggle, a 4 or 5 year long court battle, Claudia Wilkins finally, in the summer of 1998, granted the FCC their injunction against Stephen, which they had been trying to get for, I guess, starting as early as 1993. And so Free Radio Berkeley went off the air at that time, as did San Francisco Liberation Radio. We went back on the air a few months later. We called a press conference, basically saying, screw this, we're going back on the air. Then the folks over in Berkeley pretty much did the same thing, only they changed the name of the station from Free Radio Berkeley to Berkeley Liberation Radio.
And they haven't been hassled. I know they've gotten a couple of visits, but nothing serious enough to force them to close down or even put them into a panic mode, right?
Well, no, not... I mean, they, yeah, they've gotten a couple of visits. oddly enough, David Dune, who's kind of this legendary FCC agent who's been around for years and years and years, and is probably getting pretty close to retirement right now, I would judge. He was the FCC agent who shut down what was the sort of precursor to what is now known as KPOO, K-P-O-O, a licensed station here in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
They started out as kind of a pirate operation as well. But anyway, he shut down. He shut them down, and until they got a license, and they went back on the air again. And then he was the one who I had a close encounter with him one dark September night back in 1993 when he came in. Tracked me down in the middle of the night while I was doing a broadcast.
From the hills.
He's been around for years and years and years.
Right. Well, let me ask you kind of, because the history of all this, again, I want to remind listeners, can be read, and also History of Food Not Bombs in San Francisco, and Homes, I guess Homes Not Jails may even have a little reference or two in your book. Just check in into Rising Up. Richard Edmondson is the author, and if you want more information locally, callers, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Leave your name and number, and I'll put you in touch with Richard so you can either order the book directly from him, or, you know, if you want to go online with Amazon.com, you can do that. What's happening in San Francisco around, we've been talking here with, we got two guys in the studio, Richard, Jerry Henry and Scott Rhodes, who've been trying to distribute food to folks, and there's been kind of an increasing crackdown on Food Not Bombs here in Santa Cruz. It hasn't been stopped, but police are harassing people who are eating, harassing people who are sitting around when the food is served. Do you know anything about what's going on in San Francisco?
Well, not a whole lot. I have been hearing about this guy named Gavin Newsom. Who I believe is running for mayor.
Supervisor.
Advocating some very silly and very outrageous policies, such as, I don't know, fingerprinting homeless people and compiling a central database of homeless people and taking down such information as, you know, where they spend the night on this or that given night. It all sounds pretty big brotherish. It kind of sounds like the Matrix program of Frank Jordan, only maybe...
Well, it's a ratchet up, but Brown, I understand, has gone after homeless people far worse than, certainly than Jordan did in terms of the number of harassment tickets for sleeping. It's, according to Chance Martin, we're going to be playing an interview later with Chance of the Coalition on Homelessness. He has, pursued this double-faced, actually, I guess once he got in office, he became pretty obviously anti-homeless. I call him Whitewash Willie Brown. What about encampments up in San Francisco? Any word about, I know that occasionally on Liberation Radio you've had homeless folks doing shows, right?
We did, and we'd like to get some more in. That guy, you know, quit, and we had a program devoted exclusively to homeless issues now in about a year or a year and a half. But I don't know, as far as homeless encampments getting shut down, I mean, they do from time to time. I don't always necessarily hear about it when it does happen. But, you know, I have a poem for you.
Go for it.
This is actually from my new book, which is going to be coming out in probably about another month or so.
I expect an advance copy here.
I will send you one, absolutely. It's called American Bus Stop, Essay and Poems on Hope and Homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, here's a poem called Cold. C-O-L-D. It reaches the back of your neck even when you think you're curled pretty far down in your sleeping bag. Israel kicked the Palestinians again, and the economy is good. I count the years of my life. They stretch out behind me like a path to infinity. The millennium is ahead. I wrote this in 1999. Mm-hmm. People think the world is going to end or something. Or something. This is the winter of 99. 99 bottles of beer on the wall. They all have frost on the glass. The Rolling Stones said, "Gimme shelter." Where do America's homeless take shelter when all the shelters are full? Why, out here, where there's no need of a refrigerator to keep the cheese and the mayonnaise cold. Where inside is outside, and outside is inside, and the night clatters noisily by, and someone who thinks he is a vampire slits our throats while we sleep. Someone saved my life tonight. Well, don't bother saving my life, Elton John. Sing your sorrows to the dead Diana. We homeless are free. We have become free, floating ions, tearing cross-dimensionally through the universe.
Wow. And again, the name of your book is?
So that's the new one, yeah. It's coming out in a couple of months. It's called American Bus Stop. It's a collection of poems. A lot of them are about homelessness, but some of them are about other things as well.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Richard Edmondson of San Francisco Liberation Radio, who does about 8 hours of broadcasting, 10 hours of broadcasting a day, or?
The station as a whole, yeah, we're on 7 hours every day, Monday through Friday, and then we go to midnight on Monday through Thursday, and then on Friday and Saturday nights we go till midnight. We're actually in the process of moving the radio station. We have a new studio location, which we're going to be moving to in about a week or 10 days from now. It's located in the Castro, which will afford us a significantly increased elevation for our antenna. With the signal emanating from the new location, we're expecting that our listening area will expand.
How many stations are there in San Francisco?
Exponentially.
Richard, how many stations are there in San Francisco?
Well, I mean,
free radio stations.
Well, there are, you know, there's ours, and then there's a number of others which come and go. And right now, I really can't. I mean, every now and then, one of our DJs drives through the Mission District and tells me he hears some kind of station that plays nonstop disco.
That's it.
So I don't know. I mean, it's they come and go. A lot of people are, people do it for hobbies, but our station's been on the air for 9 years.
Well, I hope you can come down on Saturday, even though you can't make it on Friday. And if that doesn't happen, I guess that we'll be doing stuff on Sunday, too. And if you get down here, hey, the coffee's on me, man.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds very good.
Hey.
Are you going to call into my show on Wednesday?
I'm going to.
Should I call you?
You should call me, but you should also call me Wednesday morning on the Huff line, and I will try to. I got to confess to the audience, I have 3 times left this man dangling, so I should be slapped across the chops broadly here.
That's okay, Robert.
But listen, Richard, thank you for calling in. Is there anything you want to tell us before you go?
Oh no, I don't think so. But I guess just stay strong and stay on the air and. Long live free speech, and may the airwaves especially always be free.
Amen.
All right, take care, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Richard Edmondson, San Francisco Liberation Radio. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz. In the studio with us, waiting patiently, Scott Rhodes and Jerry Henry. We're going to talk about the latest peregrinations of Jerry Henry's case in a moment. But before we do, here's a song from Skidmark Bob and Jess Kidd.